Despicable Me 3 and then you did a Spider-Man.
Okay. Welcome to Going Off Track. Everyone wants me to tell this story.
You have to tell this story.
These guys would really like to hear about my dating life.
Yes.
I hate talking about
so
it publicly.
Juicy.
But it is fun to talk about because it's always something embarrassing. And I was telling them last night I was supposed to go see Spider-Man. I forgot to buy tickets in advance, but I was like, it's a Tuesday night. I'll just show up, buy tickets. Williamsburg, sold out. Only other movie available, Despicable Me 3. Not that crowded at 9 o'clock in Williamsburg on Tuesday night. There were probably like six other people in the theater. And
who couldn't get tickets to Spider-Man.
Couldn't get tickets to Spider-Man. Here's the thing. It was next door to Spider-Man, and we were really early. I was like, we could just go in there.
Sneak in.
But it's sold out, and two people who bought tickets are going to be totally... And it's like a smaller theater. And then I was like, well, maybe people bought tickets and aren't going to show up. But I felt too bad. So, Despicable Me 3. No. But it was fine. It became like a kind of a joke. And then it was fun. It was
but
sold out.
Really, the important question, was it better than Despicable Me 2?
Oh, did it fill in the plot holes?
I didn't see Despicable Me 2, but I own it.
Well, then how did you know what was happening?
I own it on DVD because Vanessa's voice is in it.
Yes.
At the end. She plays a stewardess.
She does. She plays a stewardess.
Okay, what about Despicable Me? I mean, obviously it can't be.
I don't think
that.
I've ever seen either the first two, but I was able to follow the plot pretty well.
You were?
Okay.
I got that they provided a lot of clues.
Hey, listen, I don't want to hear it, man. I don't want any spoilers. I'll be going to see that movie.
Are you taking everybody?
I won't be going at 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
See, my kids went last week to see Despicable Me 3, and I was given leave with my brother-in-law to go see Baby Driver. And I was like, wait, what's happening? I don't have to go sit through Despicable Me 3, and I can go see a film I actually want to see.
Wow.
It was amazing. I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, we had the opposite experience. I always go see the film I want to see.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I ever didn't, and it was my fault.
Wait, so you went with a group, including your kids?
No. We were at the beach with like all kids and cousins.
Yeah.
So my wife and her twin sister said, hey, look, it's a rainy day. We'll take the kids to see Despicable Me 3. You go with my brother-in-law and you guys go do something.
Because I've been to all these like birthday parties and stuff at the movie theater. And I go in and I go like, okay, I'm going to go to the next theater and see an adult movie while these kids are all in here watching whatever, Despicable Me 3. Problem is the kids' movies are all like 80 minutes long.
Yes.
And like there's no way I could ever get away with it.
Really? Because Despicable Me felt like it was 3 days long.
Well, hey, I'll tell you something that doesn't feel 3 days long.
Is it our podcast today?
Yeah, how's that?
That was
my first segue in 5 years.
Oh my God, I think this is my first intro in two.
Yes. Today on the podcast, John Ronson.
Yeah. Amazing.
Holy
amazing.
Shit.
Amazing. This is totally not the normal podcast for us.
This has been one of Jonah's white whales.
One of my white whales. I want to say that his new Audible series, The Butterfly Effect, debuts on July 27th. So it's coming up very soon. John Ronson, author of You've Been Publicly Shamed, helped write Okja.
Men of Stare at Goats.
Frank.
Frank.
You've heard him on... You've seen him on Jon Stewart. You've heard him on the Rogan podcast. That's how I learned about him.
This American Life.
Yeah, he's...
You know his voice. You've heard it at some point.
Yes. Yeah, he's kind of a social media expert. Like
he could probably solve the world's problems.
He could.
If we could just give him full responsibility.
Yes. Yeah, this is a great interview. So thanks. Thanks to everyone who helped set it up.
Like Stefan?
Like Stefan and his wife, thank you so much for helping out with this. And so excited that we got John to come by. And this is a great episode. We just taped it. So yeah, let's just get into it with John Ronson on Going Off Track.
It's going off track!
Brett's our bartender.
The one thing I was going to ask is, do you think I can be out in sort of about an hour or a little bit
Perfect.
Of an hour?
Oh my
Perfect.
Gosh, yes.
Only if you're brilliant and funny.
I am always.
Yeah.
Especially in my schleppy sweatpants.
I always, when I didn't realize how much of you I knew and was a fan of.
Right.
And so Jonah was like, you know, I'm a big fan of all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, I know that. Oh, shit, I read that.
Right.
Oh, God, I just, it's one of those things.
That's
and then my
cool.
first thought was when someone said, well, he's Welsh. Uh-huh. And that always makes me think of Terry Jones.
Yeah. Although, you know what? I used to live really close to Terry Jones, but not in Wales, in London.
Really?
I used to see Terry Jones all the time.
Yeah.
And Terry Gilliam. There
yeah.
was a big Python contingent around where I lived in North London.
They came, I went to the, they did a Q&A at the Ziegfeld years and years ago, and I got to go, and they had waiters walking around with platters, and they would be like, ask a question.
Right.
And put it down, and the parole room was packed, and my question got asked, and it was, what time is it? And John Cleese went, 9:15, and I was by myself, and I was like, no one to high five, no one to high five. But I know he would always give Terry Jones like crap about being Welsh.
Right.
And I always thought that was funny, but because I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, what are we? I guess we're the sort of, we're the least exciting of the Celtic races, basically.
Like, what would you compare it to in the States?
Honestly, like sort of West Virginia or somewhere.
Oh, my heavens, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, literally, because, like, it's a dying mining community.
Oh, wow.
Much of Wales is. Not. I mean, I grew up in the city, which was, like, in the capital of Wales, which was more kind of cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
But, well, I mean, when I grew up, it was kind of rough, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd get beaten up. But then again, we'd get beaten up all the time, and there wasn't any money, and all the schools were tough, and we don't have the sort of beauty, like Scotland and Ireland. This is why I say we're like the least good Celts, because Scotland and Ireland are beautiful, but Wales kind of isn't really beautiful. It's like industrial, and it's got a few beautiful little pockets, but it's not, like, if you drive through Scotland, it's all beautiful. Mm-hmm. If you drive through Wales, you're sort of looking for the beautiful bits.
Is Salcombe in Wales?
Where?
Salcombe. It's like one weird little town I went to in England when I studied there years ago. That was
right. No, well, I've not heard of it. It might be, but I haven't heard of it.
That's funny, because we've had Scottish musicians on. We had this guy, Scott Hutchinson from Frightened Rabbit.
Uh-huh.
And he was talking about how Glasgow is so depressing. And so, I guess.
My wife's from Glasgow.
Okay.
In fact, she was just there till like 2 days ago.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's a bit depressing, but it's also very beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, the west end of Glasgow is like extraordinary. It looks like, I'm trying to sort of think of an American equivalent, but just, you know, old and beautiful with like vines and like New Orleans or something.
Okay.
Not quite as nice, but.
So you said dying mining town. You just need someone to come in and like bring mining back, like
right.
what America's attempting.
Right. Exactly.
It's big, we need it. It's important.
It's true. It's true. John, I kind of found out about you originally through Joe Rogan's podcast.
Okay.
Which, and then, and I've read, you know, most of your books, and I just read Elephant in the Room. But I was curious if you listened to that Alex Jones episode that he did on Rogan.
You know, I haven't yet, and I should, and I plan to, and I still kind of text him from time to time, me and Alex. We have a sort of complicated relationship.
I can imagine. Yeah. What was his reaction like to the Elephant in the Room?
He hated it.
Really?
Yeah. Like, he said to me, oh, you know, you can say whatever you want about me, I don't care, I'm good, I love it. But they never mean that. And sure enough, he didn't mean it. He hated me, implying that that Trump was playing him. Because that's the sort of conclusion I came to, was that Trump was manipulating Alex. And Alex was the sort of, you know, because Trump would like schmooze everyone he could. And like Glenn Beck and people like that were like, ah, you know, I can see through this, like a pane of glass. But no powerful, important person had really schmoozed Alex before, so he was just really excited about it. And I mean, that's the sort of conclusion I came to anyway. But Alex really hated that. He hated thinking that, you know, he hated the idea that he was being played by Trump.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, and he also hated the fact, and I kind of understand this, that early on in the story I said that Alex was the most irresponsible man I'd ever met, but he is, and I sort of felt, you know what, I honestly felt like we were at a crisis point in our history, and Alex should not be influencing a president. And I felt like I had to say something, like it wasn't a time for pussyfooting around.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, I think that's a really brave thing to do, especially having, you know, like, I know it's hard to put that stuff out there and know people are going to see it.
Yeah. But what I mean, what I, but also in the story, I wrote about the good times that me and Alex had had. And so I sort of hoped that, that the, it would all balance each other out. But no, Alex didn't really regard the stuff I wrote about the good times. Because I did say some nice things about Alex. I said that when you go to his offices, it's very diverse.
Right.
And it is. And so, you know, nobody else would have said that about Alex. So I was really trying hard to sort of find the good stuff to talk about. And, you know, what a charismatic broadcaster he is. And you know, and he is. And so I did. I said all of that stuff too. But yeah, he didn't. I don't know. I think he's changed a little bit since when I knew him in the 90s.
Yeah.
I think he's changed. I think that Trump has made... I think they've made each other more extreme. I think Alex has made Trump more conspiratorial and Trump has made Alex more racist. I was talking about this to an old colleague of Alex's the other day, because that sounds like a big statement. And anyway, I was talking about this to an old colleague of Alex's and he agreed. He said that he didn't remember like any Islamophobia in Alex's broadcasts until like 2 years ago. In fact, quite the opposite. He was convinced that Islamism had nothing to do with 9/11.
I mean, do you feel like media in general has gotten just more extreme?
Yeah, everything's got more extreme. Everything. You know, all the worst people I ever interviewed are now in power. Alex is...
So it's your fault.
I am the conduit between Omar Bakri, between, you know, ISIS, Trump, and the British government, because I've interviewed, like, the worst members of each of them.
Do you invest in Hobby Lobby, or did they go public? Or
I interviewed this guy, Omar Bakri Mohammed, back in the 90s, who was, like, a British Islamist. And we sort of treated him quite benignly, because, you know, in 1996, there was really no chance that this little gang of radicals, of Islamic radicals, would ever have any power. So we almost treated them like a kind of farce. And in the years that followed, a whole bunch of them went off and killed people. Alex's own son, who, like, the last time I saw him, he was like this sweet little kid talking to me about how he was worried that his dad was getting such bad publicity and he'd just seen the movie Malcolm X and he was worried that this is how things would end up with his father and he was really scared. You know, this really sweet interview I had with Omar's son, lost touch with him, you know, didn't know what happened to Omar's son. Turned out he joined ISIS and then ISIS killed him. ISIS seemed like really bad bosses.
Yeah.
So... And Omar's in prison in Beirut for inciting terrorism. And a whole bunch of Omar's people have, like, driven, you know, driven vans into pedestrians. So there's that. And then I interviewed this guy called Reverend Ian Paisley, who, again, was not a big... Well, he was a very big deal back then, but he was the head of the Democratic Unionist Party, which is like a fringe Northern Irish Protestant political party in Britain, and now they've formed an alliance with the Conservative Party. And, you know, to give you an example of the DUP, one of them that I was with, Reverend David McElveen, was the head of the Save Ulster from Sodomy campaign. And, you know, now they have political power in Britain, and Alex Jones is influencing Trump. It's a disaster. Honestly, it's all the worst.
What do you think was the tipping point with all of this? Like, people just letting their extremism go unchecked and, like... Uh-huh. It's weird, because I see... Because I remember growing up in Northern Virginia, outside of D.C., and I remember the slow build of Rush Rooms, of Rush Limbaugh, people just going and sitting. And
I mean, I feel a lot of people think it's just, like, PC culture got so extreme that it's this backlash against
that. You think
that.
It's that?
I think that's definitely a component. I think social media... it encouraged people on every side to get more trenchant and harder and extreme on the right and on the left. And, you know, I sort of see it as like a polluted lake where all of us polluted the waters, and then Donald Trump emerged from it like a sort of three-eyed fish, but from the lake that we polluted. Yeah, I mean, that's what I think. It was every side did it. I felt really, you know, somebody on the left, I felt really sort of pissed off that this kind of strain of aggressive authoritarianism basically took over when ideology became much more important than humanism. I mean, it's what my last book was about, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Yeah. I just thought it was worrying and dangerous, and it certainly wasn't speaking for me. And it, sure enough, it wasn't speaking for a huge swathe of people in middle America who, you know, probably would have bought the Bernie Sanders vision of America, but didn't buy this, if you step out of line, you know, this sort of aggressive strain of identity politics where if you step out of line, we get you.
Right.
Well, that's not going to play well to, you know, people outside of Brooklyn. And sure enough, it didn't. Those people thought, well, that didn't speak to me. I'm going to vote for Trump.
Yeah.
What? I mean, speaking of You've Been Publicly Shamed, I mean, obviously there's, you know, Justine Sacco, that's a huge component of it. Uh-huh. And I've been wanting to ask you this for a long time because I've wondered about it. What is it about our culture where we like kind of, we get some kind of pleasure in tearing people down?
Well, I think people do it. I think lots of people do it for like lots of different reasons. I mean, there's some like trolls, like misogynistic right-wing trolls. I think some of them just do it because they like being dicks. Like they like they like sort of spreading, you know, jubilant chaos. But then there's some other groups of people like on the left who are doing it for ideological reasons. You know, they genuinely believe that you know, tearing down Justine Sacco is for the greater good. It's like sort of fighting a bigger battle, and now somebody said to me on Twitter today, like, how could he be a moderate like now? And what I didn't reply because I didn't want to get into a big fight with them, but you know what I would have said, and I think this is true. Other people may not, but I think, you know, extremism is the reason why we're in the mess we're in. And if being a moderate means listening to people and trying to understand each other and trying to be humanistic instead of trenchantly ideological, then I think that's the way out of this mess.
I mean, do you think there's a level of just like self-righteousness too, of being like, I'm better than this, like I didn't do this at like...
Yeah, I think there's an element to that. Like... also, you know, that is that movie Apocalypto where the Mayan deity starts drinking, you know, just needs more and more human blood. And so they're just constantly, it's like a sort of steady stream of beheaded people to sort of feed the insatiable blood needs of the Mayan deity. I think in a way that's Twitter. So when we're when we're getting someone else, we can relax. It's not going to be us.
Right, right.
You know.
Now we just have to wait for Twitter's, the people who created to get drunk and make fun of all the Jews in the world like Mel Gibson did, and then
right.
Go that way.
Yeah.
That's the first Apocalypto reference we've had on the podcast.
I think so. That's yeah, good. Finally.
That was probably, we've been waiting for this.
Right. I enjoyed Apocalypto.
I don't think I saw it.
No, I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
No.
You endured it?
It's a tough watch.
It's like Theater of Cruelty, like
yeah,
our Toad style.
It's a hard film to watch.
It's like, I didn't realize, again, because I don't, when Jonah was talking about you and the parallels, Frank really affected me, the film.
Oh, thank you.
Really affected me. And then...
Can I ask, like, this is a bit self-indulgent, but was there any particular, like, moment from Frank or...
The ending, uh-huh. when he...
I love you all.
Yeah, oh my God, that killed me. I find myself humming that a lot.
Right.
And I watched it a while ago. And also, I heard about the film and then I went backwards to learn the story. And when I learned that the keyboard player was you know, really you. That affected me even greater.
I should say that I portrayed myself in the movie as more monstrous than I hope I was in real life.
That was my, well, that was the thing, because that was that the trying to achieve, quote unquote, mainstream appeal and kind of glomming on and taking advantage of Frank. That was that affected me, because it was so sad.
Yeah. Well, you know what? And honestly, in real life, it was Frank who wanted to do that. In real life, I was in this band with this guy, Frank Sidebottom, who wore a big fake head that he never took off. And we were very marginal. But people sort of loved our marginalness. You know, we would play we'd play pretty much any city in Britain to, like, I don't know, 1,000 people, 1,500 people. And that was like a living, you know? We'd just tour, and we'd pay to 1,000 people in Liverpool or Lytham St. Anne's or whatever, and it was perfect. But then one day, Chris, who's the man underneath the Frank head, decided that, you know, he'd been doing this and plateaued, you know, like for years, and now he wanted to be more mainstream. So he brought on like a proper saxophone player and a proper bass player. And like, I don't want to sound wise after the fact, but... even like I was like 20, but I did say, like, I don't think this is going to work out. Like, our fans don't want a note perfect Frank Sidebottom O'Blimey big band. And sure enough, they didn't. You know, it was like, we were like Survivor. And the audience was like, staring at us agape, like what had happened to us. And by the end of this tour, we it was like Spinal Tap. We'd gone from like 1,000 people a night down to like 50 people. Like, word had got around. We got this terrible review in the New Musical Express, basically saying, you know, what are they thinking? This isn't the Frank Sidebottom we love. So anyway, 25 years later, I was fired at the end of that tour. We all were. And
did he fire you with the head on or off?
I think. Yeah, I don't think I was actually fired. I think suddenly the phone just stopped ringing.
Sure.
And then I began to notice that Frank was doing solo shows where he was playing his own keyboards. Mm. And I think that's what I knew. And I moved back to London.
Like the part in the film that I didn't realize that was note, like almost word for word, how it happened. How you got, like, you were booking a show at college and that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the way that I got to join the band and Frank.
Like, the dialogue is, like, the same.
Yes, the dialogue was exactly the same. They said they were looking for a keyboard player. I said, I play keyboards. They said, well, you're in. I said, but I don't know any of your songs, because the gig was that night. And they said, can you play C, F, and G? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, you're in. So, and that's exactly how
I can play C, F, and G.
I know.
So, you don't have to touch the black notes. It's great.
But anyway, 25 years later, I'm talking to my friend Peter Straud, and he's suggesting that we write a movie sort of inspired by my time in the Frank Sidebottom band. And Peter said, you know, I think it would be better if you were the one who wanted to make the band more mainstream. And I saw, I'd never... Like, I was raised as a journalist, so the idea of, like, making something up like that was, like, revelatory to me. And Peter sort of looked at me patiently and said, you know, we are allowed to make things up, you know. So that's why in the movie it's the John character who tried to make the band more mainstream. Because I think in movies, things need to be slightly simpler. Yeah. You know, Frank has to be the sort of outsider artist. John has to be the malevolent force trying to tear everything apart.
It's an intense film. It's great.
Thank you.
And the fact that you're like, let's see... Who's ridiculously handsome we can shove underneath that paper mache? Oh, Michael Fassbender. Sure, why not? Shove him under. And it's so good.
Yeah, you know, it never really surprised me that I always thought, both me and Peter always thought, this film will only get made if we get a big star to play Frank. Yeah. And we will get a big star to play Frank, because some big star's going to want to spend an entire movie underneath a big fake head. Yeah. And in fact, Michael Fassbender was, I think, the first person to read it. Like, we never sent it out. Like, Michael Fassbender read it and said he wanted to do it, and then it just happened.
How did he get... Were you just hanging out and you said, here, read this?
No,
and you said you didn't send it out.
I don't hang out with Michael Fassbender.
Come on.
He's
very magnetic.
I used to think...
Nobody gets that. And Magneto.
I once thought that he'd somehow got hold of a copy of the screenplay. But I've got a feeling that was a bit romanticized, and actually somebody at Film 4 or at the one of the agents had sent it to him. But I don't know for certain.
Okay.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Thank you. I'm really proud of Frank. One great thing that came from Frank was that Bong Joon-ho, the Korean director, was a big fan of Frank, and as a result asked me to co-write Okja with him, mm-hmm. Which only just came out.
Yeah.
And I love Okja. I think
did you know him from Host or Snowpiercer or?
No, I didn't. I sort of only vaguely knew him, and then after I met him, I went back and watched all of those films.
Yeah.
But the first time I met him, I hadn't seen any of his films.
Snowpiercer, that's another intense film. I didn't know that was a comic.
Right,
That was kind of my thing for a little while, and I was annoyed that I hadn't read it.
Right.
But did he shoot Okja? Like, does he still shoot the edit? Like, does he still shoot that way?
Yes.
Ah, it's so crazy. He like...
What does that mean?
You gang shoot, like, we're going to do all the inside scenes here, we're going to do all this, but he shoots the way he's going to edit
order?
The film.
Yeah. What it means
it's
is that
expensive.
And they don't let... It means that the scenes don't really play out as scenes, because he basically shoots the shot, and then the next shot is the shot that's going to cut into that shot. So so basically, you know, they spend ages setting up for 10 seconds. It was amazing. And then there's a guy sitting right there on set who's editing the film as Bong shoots it. But I should say, though, that like, so by the end of the shoot, you've got a finished film.
Right.
But it still took him 6 months in the edit to get it right.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, afterwards.
That's insane.
I don't even understand. Like, I watched Okja the other night, and uh-huh. I don't understand how you even act. Like, it's... The character, the pig, whatever, like, it's... I don't understand how you can even act around that, because it looks so great, but I kept thinking about how you would shoot it.
Well, it was a guy holding some rubber. and the rubber kind of looked a little bit like Okja's head. I tell you when I knew that this, because I love Okja, and I hope you guys like it.
Yeah, it's great.
I think it's wonderful. And I think the moment I knew this, it was going to really work, was at the very first time I saw a rough assembly of it at the end in the slaughterhouse. It's basically, you know, it's a man holding some rubber, and I was watching it on my iPhone. And I was still in tears. And I thought, you know, wow, if the film's going to make me cry like this, then, you know, when it's completely finished. And sure enough, every time I've seen it in a cinema with an audience, there's just sobs all around me. And people have started posting videos of themselves sobbing uncontrollably at the end of Okja on Twitter. That's become a thing. And I love it. I think every time I see one of these, I think... I'd be like Cartman at the end that episode of South Park. Like, I'll lick up your tears. I'd drink your tears. I sort of felt I contributed to these tears. Because it's so, you know, in the sort of stifling ennui of life where nobody feels anything anymore, to be able to like cut through to people's souls that way is so great.
Make you cry. It's CGI, motherfucker.
Yeah. I realize that sounds glib, but it's not glib. I feel, what I really mean is that I just feel like incredibly proud to have contributed to a film that's moved people so much.
What was the connection? How did you meet him?
He was a fan of Frank, so he just called me up.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And the casting in Okja is insane too. I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah, totally. For the first time, because with Frank, I never got to work with any of the actors, which I think is normal for a screenwriter. Like, the screenwriter writes the film and then hands it over to the director, and then, you know, the director's the one who has the relationship with the actors. But in Okja, Tilda was involved. Tilda Swinton was involved right from the beginning, from even before me. So I was having, like, Skypes with Tilda while I was writing the screenplay, and that was great.
Did you ever call her Orlando?
No, but you know what? She's not intimidating. You would think somebody as sort of otherworldly as Tilda Swinton would be intimidating.
Did you meet her?
I met her, yeah. My sister was in that film Trainwreck with Tilda Swinton, and I met her at the premiere, and she was so nice, like
she's so
cool.
Nice. Yeah.
I love her.
What part did your sister play?
She played Amy Schumer's best friend.
Oh, okay.
They kind of like are gossiping at work.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
But yeah, it was very cool.
I'm friends with... You must have met Kim, Amy Schumer's sister.
Yeah, yeah,
Kim.
I know. Yeah, I went to Europe with her. I know Kim pretty well.
Yeah, I'm good friends with Kim.
They're great.
I love Kim.
I do too. She's awesome. I mean, what? Obviously, you have this kind of new Audible project coming out as well. I mean, how did that come about? It's like sort of hard to keep track of all your stuff because I feel like you're working in so many mediums.
I am. It's because when I was about just after Frank Sidebottom fired me, I started working for this late night radio show in Manchester. And it was like my life. I'd turn up at the studio and at 10 at night and I'd broadcast. Honestly, I was so happy broadcasting into the night till 1 in the morning. And did it for a couple of years. And then the radio station got taken over and we were all called into the new boss's office and fired one by one. And as he fired me, he rubbed my back sympathetically. And as he was rubbing my back and firing me, I was thinking, never again am I going to let some person control my life. So ever since then, I've always tried to have like a million different projects going at once. So as a kind of buffer against failure and my audiobooks have always people like my audiobooks. So then Audible came to me and said they wanted to do like original content, like highly produced narrative audio series. And did I want to do one? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. So we just finished. It's called The Butterfly Effect. And the whole season is following the flap of a butterfly's wings through to its consequences. And the kind of, it's kind of experimental way of doing a narrative, I think, that if you sort of trace the consequence out and out and out, where might you end up? Like how far from the original flap of the butterfly's wings might you end up if you just follow this, the ripples? So in season one of The Butterfly Effect, the flap of the butterfly's wings is this boy called Fabian in Brussels having a brainwave, and his brainwave was to get rich from giving the world free porn, free online streaming porn. So he's basically the brains behind Pornhub. And to give you just one example of where the ripples ended
up. I'm unfamiliar with Pornhub. I have no idea what you're talking about.
To give you an example of where we ended up, by the end of episode two, from consequence through to consequence, three women are setting fire to a Norwegian man's stamp collection.
Oh my God.
Then at the end of episode four, a boy in Oklahoma with autism is forced to move house to a house on the very edge of town. And then at the end of episode five, a man in New Orleans kills himself. I probably shouldn't, like, I don't know if I should tell you like how I got from one to the other, because I think it's just I love the sort of mystery.
Yeah, everyone should check it out. I was curious what you thought of Black Mirror.
Well, I really like Black Mirror, and I mean, I like some more than others, but I think that's like everyone feels that way. But I know Charlie Brooker pretty well, and
because it seems like one of the episodes was sort of maybe based on one of your ideas or very similar.
Yeah, one episode of Black Mirror was definitely inspired by a couple of chapters from So You've Been Publicly Shamed. I know because Charlie Brooker gave interviews where he said it, and it was the episode Hated in the Nation. The one with the killer bees?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a woman in that one who's been shamed on the internet for doing something stupid at a war memorial. And that's totally from So You've Been Publicly Shamed, where I tell the story of this woman called Lindsay Stone, who was in front of, she was a care worker. She works with adults with learning difficulties. But she had this kind of douchey joke that she'd share with her friend where she would post on Facebook photographs of her posing in front of a sign and doing the opposite of what was happening on the sign. So she'd smoke in front of a no smoking sign and loiter in front of a no loitering sign. Anyway, she took the people in her care on a trip to Washington, D.C. And, they went to the Mint and they went to the Holocaust Museum, and at night they did karaoke, they're having a great time, and then they went to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And firstly, there was a sign that said, keep off the grass. And Lindsay sort of said to her friend, dare we? And They were like, no, 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 we don't want to get into trouble. So then they saw a sign that said silence and respect. And as Lindsay said, inspiration struck. So she posed in front of the sign, pretending to shout and flip the finger and put it on Facebook. Nothing happened for like a month. And then a month later, she was like worldwide trending and just destroyed. Didn't leave home for a year and a half, you know, contemplating suicide and, you know, believed every single negative tweet and Facebook comment about her. Got fired from her job, you know, became the epitome of... she was attacked by the right. It was the right. It was like the militaristic right who were getting Lindsay. But the impact it had on her mental health was kind of extraordinary. Anyway, I think Charlie Brooker wrote that episode of Hated in the Nation sort of based on that.
I mean, do these people, like obviously with Justine Sacco and stuff, you visited her much later after this stuff had happened. No?
Sorry, I had beer in my mouth. first time I met Justine was like, 2 weeks after it happened.
Holy oh, really? Shit.
Yeah, she was still, like, broken.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
The Tuning Unknown Soldier thing, like, my father was in the military, and I got to go to the barracks back where they train them and meet all those guys and all that. And, you know, they're already a super hardcore bunch, and it's such this crazy honor, that whole area. Mm. Like, you have to, not only do you have to have, like, the merit to do it, you have to be, like, a certain height. It's the weirdest thing. You have to, like, be, like, you know, pass everything. They haze the crap out of you and all this. Not, like, crazy stuff, just different oaths and things you have to say. But it's, like, super reverent. Like, I feel bad for this woman for doing that kind of thing. But there had to have been a moment where you go, maybe don't. And I always think about that because I've had those moments. I've done beyond stupid things in print and stuff like that. And there's... You're like, what?
No, you haven't.
But you know, when she posted it on Facebook, she and like a couple of her friends said, I think this is like, I'm in the military. I think this is a bit disrespectful. Yeah. I think you should take it down. And, you know, she sort of posted back, saying, yeah, what are you talking about? You know us. It's just us being douches. You know, it's just a joke about a sign. And like her military friend was sort of a bit grumpy about it. And then Lindsay said to me that her friend said to her, like, do you think we should take it down? And Lindsay was like, no. And then, but, they thought that all their privacy settings were like only their friends would see this.
Ah.
But something was unticked that should have been ticked. And that's how she became America's most hated woman for a little while.
Shit. Insane. That doesn't even really seem, you know, everyone's trying to get coverage. So hard, and that doesn't even really seem like a big deal to me. It takes off.
Yeah. This is what I mean about sort of ideology versus humanism. Like, nobody wanted, like, sure, I mean, you know, but with Justine Sacco too, like, these are not great jokes, although I would argue that Justine Sacco's joke was a bad example of an honourable liberal comedic tradition of mocking your own privilege. But, you know, basically these are not great jokes, but everyone's like so desperate to like pull an individual out of the crowd and make them bear the weight of an ideology on their shoulders. And that's what happened to Lindsay. In Lindsay's case, it was the right wanting to like get feminism. No, nobody knew whether or not Lindsay was a feminist, but so many of the comments were like typical feminist. Or like the left or liberals, like typical disrespectful hipster liberal. No one knew whether that was true about Lindsay. In fact, I mean, I don't know what Lindsay's politics are, but she's not like a, she doesn't live in Fort Greene. She lives in a house in the woods in Massachusetts.
Right. I mean, I had something not directly happen to me, but similar. I play in a band with this guy, Jeff, and his label was funded by Martin Shkreli. And he was, when all that stuff happened with the AIDS drug getting jacked up and he became the most hated guy, Jeff was on a plane to England with his band and they were about to put out their record and then he landed and that whole, you know, it's like that whole idea of just being out of touch and then landing and then being kind of associated with this person that's just like kryptonite.
What's Jeff's surname?
Jeff Rickley.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say Jeffrey Lewis.
No. But yeah, and that Martin Shkreli guy. But I feel like he's different because he like revels in sort of being a villain.
He is different. I mean, I don't know what psychology is going on that makes him revel in it. But you're right, he does. Yeah, he's different. I think to the people that I was writing about because I decided to give myself the rules. And so you've been publicly shamed that I'd only really write about private individuals whose punishments were disproportionate to their crimes. Whereas, I mean, I've got sort of feelings about Martin Shkreli, however you pronounce it, but he wouldn't have fitted into my book,
right?
Because he's a public figure. He's sort of pushing himself out there as a public figure, who is kind of repulsive. He wants to, but like Piers Morgan, he sort of, for some weird reason, he wants to be a pantomime villain.
Yeah, that stuff fascinates me because I love satire, and it's tricky. You know what I mean? It's very, very tricky.
Yeah,
how you deal with that, and it's going on for forever. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare, tricky. Yes. It's hard to deal with that stuff. So when people don't get the joke, but then you're trying to figure out, well, what was the intent of the satire to begin with? What were you trying to say?
Yeah, I mean, we're just in Sacco. If people don't remember the joke, it was she's about to get on a plane and she tweets, "Going to Africa. Hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding. I'm white." I would argue that actually you don't need to think about that sentence more than about 5 seconds before at least some doubt would creep in that it was intended to be taken at face value. Mm. I'm a big fan of Randy Newman, and his songs are full of like mocking his own privilege by doing an exaggerated version of it. His lyrics are full of that stuff. And so I recognize Justin Sacco's joke for being an example of that.
I mean, I feel like Daniel Tosh could say that on TV and no one would think twice about it.
Right. So again, there was like a lot of willful misunderstanding. A sort of ideological frenzy took over the world that night. And a lot of people had to pretend to themselves that they didn't get the joke.
Well, what I think is interesting too and cool about the book is no one really stands up for these people.
Mm. No one did.
Yeah.
Standing up for Justin Sacco that night would have been dangerous. And when I say standing up for them, even if you'd tweeted that night, "Can we not just wait till the plane lands to hear what she has to say?" That would have been seen as a weakness. Just patience would have been seen as a weakness.
What compelled you to sort of write the book and sort of get those people's point of views out?
I think it's because, I had no particular, if I've been totally honest, like me and Justine Sacco come from totally different worlds. On a personal level, she's not really somebody I'd be friends with. Like she goes partying, she's young, she lives in the Lower East Side.
She's like Sarah Lewitton.
Right. Yeah. Who I like very much.
Yes,
by her, but
yes,
she's exactly.
Me too.
Whereas I'm quiet and introverted and, never she. But I felt that we'd lost our minds. And I felt we'd lost our minds in a way that was kind of anathema to everything I'd learned about the way the world, about how we should perceive our fellow humans. Like I've just spent this year for the butterfly effect in the porn world, being with porn stars and stuff. You would not believe the prejudice is against porn people. They are stigmatized. They can't get checking accounts. Fabian, the head of Pornhub, wanted a bank loan to help him expand, to build an empire based in part on handling pirated content. I should probably explain this, right?
Sure.
Pornhub is filled with pirated content illegally uploaded by fans. Pornhub themselves don't illegally upload the pirated stuff, but fans do, and Pornhub hosts it until they're told to take it down.
They are the VCR.
Right. So when Pornhub became big, the valley collapsed, the San Fernando Valley collapsed, all these mom-and-pop porn businesses. All these mom-and-pop porn companies were going out of business. Porn performers had to take up escorting to pay the rent.
Pornhub killed Chatsworth.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it did.
Northridge is destroyed.
Pornhub killed the valley.
Yeah.
It certainly killed the part of the valley which cared about production value. So a lot of crews lost their jobs. A lot of camera people lost their jobs.
I've met a bunch of those dudes because when you work in TV in California, mm-hmm. when you're not shooting, you can say, "Tell me your story," and they know what you're going to ask.
Right.
And you go, "All right, we're on a hill." And they just start telling great stories.
Right.
So, yeah.
So Fabian, let me just go back to this. So Fabian thought, okay, all these production companies in the valley are now fucked because of Pornhub. If I can get a bank loan, I can buy up a lot of the competition. Like, they'll sell it to me at cut price. But if you're a porn star and you want to get a checking account, like, you go to the bank, they say, what do you do for a living? You say you're a porn star. They won't give you a checking account because they think it's going to, like, be bad for their reputation to have a porn star in their branch. So a porn star can't get a checking account. Fabian, who wanted to set up a business based on getting rich from handling those women's stolen porn, got a $362 million loan from a hedge fund to do it. So that's what I'm talking about, kind of stigma. Like, porn people are so stigmatized. Someone even said to me on Twitter not long ago, I mean, I'm sure she regretted saying it, but this woman said to me, you know, why are you making something about porn people? Like, who cares what porn people have to say about anything? So, but I've spent a year with these people and I found beautiful stories about lovely people who have an interesting way of seeing the world. And they're delightful. I kind of love a lot of the people that I've been hanging out with this past year. And for 30 years, I've been telling stories about people on the fringes of society. And quite often, I don't like them in the way that I like my porn people. But they very often give, like, really interesting perspectives on the world. You know, sometimes to go to the very, sometimes to understand our world, what you need to do is go to the kind of very edges of it and listen to them and try and see our world through their eyes. And on, you know, to be, what I'm saying is to be curious and non-judgmental. So over 30 years of telling stories, I'm like, that's how to do it. That's the way to see the world. It's kind and it's humanistic and it's the right way to see the world. Twitter comes along, and for the first couple of years, I think Twitter was like that. We had a window into other people's lives, and we used it to be kind of curious. And everybody, and it was like a sort of place where people could tell the truth about themselves. But then it grew darker and colder, and now it's a place for people to get other people. And when I saw that shift, I felt so like, this is the opposite of what I know is the right way to see the world. That's what compelled me to write that book.
That's really interesting. And with the porn thing, it seems so hypocritical for, I'm sure all these people watch porn. Mm. Maybe not all, but most of them.
Yeah.
And then,
all do. Every single one of them. And including, I'm sure, the bank managers who won't give them checking accounts. Yeah, so hypocritical.
I mean, do you feel like...
it's so interesting. I was having this conversation with... It's like this weird moralistic sense that when you get older, you're just like, well, who the fuck are you? People, you know, do whatever. We had one of our friends, and here's an author who wrote this book, Meet Me in the Bathroom, Lizzie Goodman. She did this amazing piece on Stoia.
Oh, yeah, I've met Stoia.
Yeah. And the piece is incredible. And it it touches on the perspective of, like... feminism in that world, which is, there's almost a weird push for equality when, you know, back in the day when people were getting paid more, that it was like, well, the women got paid way more. It was this very interesting dichotomy.
Well, women still do get paid more in porn than men.
Good.
Can I tell you a story about Stoia?
Please.
Yes.
Okay, this isn't in my porn series, mainly in the Butterfly Effect, mainly because I recorded Stoia so poorly. It was kind of really hard to listen to as part of an otherwise very well recorded audio series. But it really speaks to what we were just talking about. So Stoia said to me, she was complaining about not being able to get a checking account, you know, or a mortgage because she's a porn star. She said, you know, things were a little bit easier for her because she was on the cover of Village Voice or something on New York magazine. So she's like a porn star who also has some kind of, you know, hipster credibility. So it made things a little bit easier for her. But nonetheless, anyway, she said that she does all this work trying to, you know, convince journalists to kind of listen to porn stars when it comes to, like, I don't know, condom laws and so on in California, like, listen to the porn stars, you know, we're the ones who sort of live it. So she does all of this work, but then she sees, like, her stolen porn on Pornhub, and it's not labelled sort of interesting Stoia, feminist Stoia, whatever. It's labelled dumb slut whore. And she says, you know, when you give our stuff away for free, and then label the people that you're giving away for free, dumb teen slut whore. We have to work so much harder. Anyway, what Stoya may not know is that I put that to Fabian. I said, this is what Stoya said. And he said, well, the first thing I want... Fabian's about who was in charge of Pornhub. And he said, well, the first thing I want to say is that, like, we aren't the ones who label the videos dumb slut whore. It's the fans, who are illegally uploading it onto Pornhub who are labelling the videos that way. He said, but to be totally honest with you, it helps us because we want to get to the top of the Google search rankings, and feminist porn star Stoya isn't going to work. But dumb slut whore, that's what people are Googling.
Oh, man. I mean, do you, with Twitter and all the stuff we've been talking about, I mean, I feel like people are still sort of figuring out the etiquette. I mean, do you feel like it's just going to go darker? Or do you think there'll be a backlash where people get sick of just like this type of stuff? Or
I mean, there was a bit of a, I kind of think that my book and at the same time that my book came out, Monica Lewinsky did a very similar, you know, a TED talk that was very similar to what my book was about. And then some other people, sort of heroes of the left, like Glenn Greenwald, got involved and said sort of similar things too. And I think as a result of us, I think we changed the argument a bit. So I think that, like, when somebody's getting destroyed nowadays, they're getting destroyed in a slightly less aggressive way. People are slightly remembering, like, my book and Monica's TED talk and so on. So I think things have got a little bit better. But my fear is that when all this Trump nonsense is over, things are going to go back to exactly how they were that allowed Trump to get elected in the first place. I think this sort of polarization and everybody retreating to their corners and yelling at each other, and the more hardcore and ideological you are, I'm talking about, you know, left and right here, then, you know, the more rewarded you are. I don't think any of that's really kind of going to change. And I think, you know, well, finally Trump will go, but the ambience from which Trump emerged is going to go back to how it was, I think.
How do you find, like, I guess, strength in moderation? Because I get very polarized when I find, like, you know, friends of friends or whatever, or like my wife's friends are like, well, they voted for Trump. My first thought is, well, fuck them. And I can't, I have this hard problem. I was listening to turn on NPR yesterday, had my kids in the back seat, and it was a story about how to talk to your children about the president. And he said, and my son said, you know, I hear the president doesn't like brown boys. And I'm like, dah! And I, you know, change it. And of course, my 6-year-old in the back goes, why doesn't the president like brown boys? And I'm like, because there's people in there, you know, and he's just a bad guy. And I just changed the channel. And it's right. Hard to, like, I try to, like, I can't see the perspective. You know what I mean?
Well, this is what someone said to me today. Like, how can you be a moderate now? I think most people who voted for Trump aren't bad people. They were let down. They were let down by the mainstream. They were let down by everyone. You know, the mainstream media and the left. Like, you know, when was the last time the mainstream media and you know, people on the left cared about the concerns of middle Americans losing their jobs? Like, you know, no one cared. People thought they were just stupid. So, of course, you're going to end up voting for Trump when you feel like that. But, you know, most, you know, I travel America, like, all the time, like, and have done for decades. And I spend a lot of my time in, you know, Arkansas and, you know, middle America and so on. And I don't meet bad people. I meet lovely people. But I meet people who, you know, who were let down by the coastal elites. I'm quite honestly, I mean, I'm probably exaggerating a little bit, but not that much. Not that much. Like, nobody cared. That's why I'm pretty convinced that if Bernie Sanders had got the nomination instead of Hillary, things might have been different, because he spoke to them. I mean, I hope whoever comes next on the left is going to speak to them, you know, whether it's Joe Biden or, I don't know, Alfred
Dwayne
Duncan
Johnson.
Whoever it is.
All going to be wrestling, dude. Of course, after Trump, a wrestler
is
going to
be The Rock.
Of course, dude. Because that's because he's a wrestler. And Trump's a wrestler, and he treats it like wrestling.
Right.
It's all promos. It's all promos.
Although, don't you think that, like, a kind of non... Do you think he's doing such a... Like, people aren't going to want another non-politician after Trump, don't you think?
Yeah, I hope.
My fear is that he's just weakened the system so that it appears that anybody can get in there.
Took away the legitimacy of it all.
What do you think about the left's sort of, I mean, sort of what you've been saying about kind of your journalistic question of curiosity, asking questions? I mean, it seems, you know, I identify with the left, but also I have this problem with them, like, not wanting speakers that don't agree with them.
Yeah.
Like, writing. I mean, do you think that lack of dialogue from other voices is something that's kind of a dangerous thing?
Yeah, I do. You know, you can always find somebody who shouldn't, like, have a platform at a college. Like, I'm not going to, like... You know, like, I can totally understand why someone like Milo Yiannopoulos isn't given a platform at college. But then, you know, the next thing that happens is Ann Coulter's not given a platform at college. I mean, she was banned from, like, Berkeley or somewhere. And so, you know, so I think, you know, the problem with the no platforming thing is that it's just, it's kind of aggressive. And again, it turns people off.
And I think it elevates these people too.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly elevated Milo Yiannopoulos. He knew exactly what to do with it. I think it's just proven, you know, you'll always find people who don't deserve a platform. And God knows I've met a lot of them myself. But, you know, when that becomes your default position, all it's going to do is just, people don't want to be bothered with that shit. But, you know, most people don't want a left that, if you step slightly out of line, you're silenced or relentlessly pursued or punished. Like that. Like, who wants that? Yeah. I believe in curiosity and trying to understand people and humanism. And I hope none of this makes me like a sap. Because I also believe in social justice. I believe in all the things they believe in. But I just think the way that they're going about it is all wrong.
What would you change?
I wouldn't have a sort of no platforming policy. I just believe in listening to people and trying to understand people. You know, I believe in what Obama believed in. Obama, after those five cops were killed a year ago, yesterday I think it was, or 2 days ago, those five police officers in Dallas, Obama gave like a really powerful speech where he said, you know, you turn on the internet and you see people retreating to their corners and doubling down and digging in their heels, and it's hard to think that the center won't hold and that things won't get worse. Well, I mean, he was right. The center didn't hold and things did get worse. And Obama's last speech was, you know, if I remember rightly, Obama's like farewell speech addressed all of these things, like listen to people, try and understand people, don't silence your enemies, listen to your enemies.
I'm trying to think if there's something like upbeat we can end things.
Yeah, of course, this has been a much more somber, usually I'm much more like...
So when is Bilderberg going to step in and just make everything better? That's the first thing I saw that you did, by the way. I didn't even know it was you until talking to Jonah or emailing with Jonah about this. I was like, fuck, I remember watching that.
Yeah. Yeah, that was scary. I tried to sneak into a Bilderberg meeting in 1996, I think it was. And I got chased. Like, we tried to get into the hotel. I was with Big Jim Tucker, a journalist who dedicated his life to trying to expose the Bilderberg group. Mm-hmm. And so we snuck around the hotel and then we got followed by men in dark glasses and a chase ensued. I say a chase, but I was going 30 miles an hour, so was the guy chasing me. But if I'd gone faster, I think he'd have gone faster. And it was I've never been so scared in all my life. I phoned up the British Embassy and I said, I'm being chased by the Bilderberg group. I'm in Portugal and I'm being chased by the Bilderberg group. And they went, and then they went, go on.
How fast are you going?
I said, what are you doing here? She said to me, what are you doing here? And I said, I am essentially a humorous journalist out of my depth. can you phone the Bilderberg Group and explain that to them? So she did. She called up the Bilderberg Group and then called me back and said, by this time I was back at my hotel, and she said, the Bilderberg Group want you to know that nobody is following you. And as she was saying this to me, there was a man behind the tree staring at me. And she said, this is the bit I'll always remember. I remember all of this. But the part that really stays with me was the next thing she said, which is that the good news is if you know you're being followed, they're probably just trying to intimidate you. And the dangerous ones would be those that you don't know are following you. But I thought to myself, well, what if they are the dangerous ones that just happen to be like naturally good at spotting them?
Yet it was so easy for you to sneak into Bohemian Grove.
Yeah, sneaking into Bohemian Grove proved incredibly easy. We literally just walked up the drive and sort of gave the security guard a little wave. We said, have fun. Whereas Alex Jones went in through the undergrowth and got a poison ivy rash. Sometimes it just shows that sometimes going up the drive is easier than going through the undergrowth.
Very good.
All right.
Okay, listen, Bilderberg Group, I hope you're cool with us because I know you're listening. Just saying, like, you guys, Skulls, like, Z, Imp, whatever the fuck you got going on, we're cool, right? We're cool. We're cool.
The Butterfly Effect, July 27th, comes out on Audible. Also, shout out to Pulse.
Without whom none of this would music. Be possible.
Pulse Music, who let us record once again, who are awesome, and you should record stuff here.
And he's really responsible for this particular episode happening.
Yes, yes, in many ways.
Also, and, shout out to a literal pulse that if you didn't have, you wouldn't be able to hear us.
Yes, you would not. You would be dead. And check out The Butterfly Effect, read all John's books.
Go see Frank if you haven't.
Go see Frank. Definitely, yeah, see Okja. It's on Netflix. You have Netflix anyways. Or you'll be like me and just watch people arguing with the TSA on YouTube all night on your huge TV and then fall asleep and be like, why did I do that again? If you like that podcast, you can support us. You can go to Venmo and send money to @offtrack. That will go to Brad Worrell. You can also donate our site, I think. You can leave us a nice review on iTunes. You can tweet at us. You can tell people about us.
You can hit us up a message on Facebook.
Yes, message on Facebook.
The only thing I use Facebook for is
Steven uses that. You can also, if you want to advertise with us, you know, you'll reach lots of people.
True.
And sell lots of
your. Or if you want to learn how to ruin a lot of advertising deals, we will tell you.
Yeah.
We can do that too.
We're pretty consistent.
We can do it all. But thank you so much to Pulse and John Ronson. And we'll be back next week with another fun episode, guys. Maybe darker than this one. Maybe
no,
more levity.
Please.
You never know.
We're cool, Bilderberg.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.